Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
This is John Cass. I want to thank all of you, the tens of thousands of you who've joined up and signed up for JohnCassNews.com, my new adventure after leaving the Chicago Tribune after 40 years. It's been a crazy week, right? I left my job, left the job I loved. Really had no choice. And now, starting a new thing. Meeting with lawyers and with web designers, great web designers. They put this thing up in a couple days. But we still want to work out some kinks, and one of them is we want to be able to notify you for every time there's new content on the website. So we're doing that, and I've got some columns planned up. You know, last week I did the unbearable lightness of Lightfoot, the mayor of Chicago who's lost her city. This week, I've got some planned already, new ones, including, I think I should do one on Mr. Ayala, Angel Ayala. Have you heard about him? He was convicted of aggravated battery in 2019 in Chicago. He was arrested for carjacking in 2018. He was on bail just the other day for having a AR-15 in his car, in the car he was driving in, riding in. Yeah, he was on bail for that, according to, you know, court records and CWB website. And then he had, the other day, he got out of another car at the Puerto Rican Day Parade and began allegedly, according to prosecutors, flashing street gang signs, allegedly pulls out a gun, and allegedly begins firing. And apparently it's all on video. He fires so wildly with all this stuff on his record that one of the bullets crosses the street and kills an innocent woman, Nicole Osborne, shoots her in the back when she was walking with her husband. And where is the pack of journalists outside Tony Preckwinkle's office asking her, as Cook County Board Chairman, as Chairman of the Cook County Democratic Party, as the patron of Cook County State's Attorney Kim Fox, whose only job before this, or her main job before this, was acting effectively as Tony Preckwinkle's secretary, and she now has been made reelected county prosecutor in Cook County. Where is the mob of journalists, you know, pack out there in front of Kim Fox and Tony Preckwinkle's office asking, how the hell did Ayala walk? How was he on bail walking around the street? What are the policies that Fox and Preckwinkle and the third of the three stooges, Chief Judge Tim Evans, what are their policies, and how did those policies affect Miss Osborne, Nicole Osborne, being shot in the back by a guy who should have been in jail? Yeah, I know Lori Lightfoot is unbearable. Yes, she's lost the city, but there's more to it than that. Anyway, that might be a column, but right now, Jeff and I are pleased to tell you a story. You ever hear about Sherlock Holmes, considered a brilliant detective in his own mind? Anyway, no, he was a brilliant detective, Sherlock Holmes. Everybody knows it. And Cumberbatch, Basil Rathbone, Jeremy Brett, other people have played him. But Sherlock Holmes had something that few of his fans knew. He had a smarter brother, Mycroft. And while I'm not Sherlock Holmes and I don't speak in a clipped British accent, and I speak basically Chicagoese with my ragged diphthongs and harsh vowels. I have a brother too, two of them, and both are smarter than me. And you're going to meet one today on the Chicago Way podcast. Jeff Carlin is here, as always, from the executive producer of WGN Radio and my friend, good man, co-host, as always, and master of sound. And I'm John Cass, formerly a columnist at a newspaper in Chicago. Had no choice but to leave. And now I'm starting my own venture called JohnCassNews.com. And you're welcome to come on board and sign up. And of course, not Mycroft Holmes or Sherlock Holmes will be here, but my brother Nick will be here, and you're going to hear all about him. An extremely distinguished career in the intelligence community, diplomatic community, in our government, the United States government, in foreign affairs he specialized in. And that's his picture, photograph on the top of this podcast out in the border regions of Turkey. And where are you? Maybe walking on North Avenue with your friends, with your husband or wife. Maybe you were walking on that same spot where Nicole Osborne was shot, allegedly by someone who should have been in jail for other violent crimes and wasn't, because this is woke. We are now governed by the woke, and you're reaping the benefits of all that governance. Where are you? As Mycroft Holmes comes on and talks to me about how smart he is, and he is. And the family of Cheryl Osborne prepares to bury her. You're on the Chicago Way on WGN Plus.
In a tower by the river, there lived a man.
Castle.
There was a man who took a stand with pen and paper in his hand, defeating foes in every ward with a pen more mighty than the sword. No escape from his ink lasso in a tower by the river, Castle.
Here's how you get him. He pulls a knife, you pull a gun, he sends one of yours to the hospital, you send one of his to the morgue. That's the Chicago Way.
As promised, we try to bring you great guests here on the Chicago Way, and we are bringing you one that you've never heard here before and knows so much about me, he could fill volumes. He is a consultant with over 30 years of foreign policy experience in our federal government as analyst, collector, diplomat, policy manager, and leader. He was Deputy Assistant Secretary of State in the Bureau of Conflict and Stabilization Operations. He was twice Director for European Affairs and Director of Intelligence Programs at the National Security Council. He also served as Deputy National Intelligence Officer for Europe and Senior Analyst for the Aegean, Eastern Mediterranean, and Kurdish issues at the National Intelligence Council. He's been a team chief for legislative affairs, liaison with Congress, and as deputy political counselor, he was political officer at the U.S. Embassy in Ankara, Turkey. His main mission point was developing relationships with leading pro-Islam politicians, Kurdish activists, academics, religious, and minority leaders. He also served at the Central Intelligence Agency, including as intelligence briefer to the Director of Central Intelligence. He holds a Juris Doctor from Columbus School of Law at Catholic University. He holds a Master of Arts in Government from Georgetown and a Bachelor of Arts from DePaul. He speaks Turkish and Kurdish and Chicago. And he worked with me chopping chickens at the butcher shop when we were kids. This is my brother, Nicholas Cass. Hey, Nick.
Hey, John. How are you? Hi, Jeff. How are you? Again, great to make your virtual acquaintance.
You too, Nick. Welcome to the Chicago way.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I have to say, point of parliamentary procedure here, if I might, I think it's a really fun time to be here. It's a really important moment, I think, in journalism, particularly in Chicago, but also throughout the country. And it's clear that with you, John, with your departure from the Tribune and your arrival at johncastnews.com, which is, as I recall, the sponsor of this podcast, that you are now at the locus of pound for pound, the best podcast and news site in the city, bar none. And I'm very, very happy for you, very proud that you've been able to make that transition and so seamlessly, and that I know your readers are really, really appreciative. It's astounding, actually, to be out here in Loudoun County. You know, so I'm beaming to you from, you know, behind the wall here, and to hear how many people really get into what you're saying. And anyway, thank you again for having me on. It's really, really terrific to be here.
I think it'll be interesting for our listeners to hear the smartest man in the known universe and me and Jeff, but you're the smartest. And also, Jeff is dying to ask questions about your reaction to me, you know, while you're, even though you briefed presidents and interviewed chiefs of state and had all these high level meetings that you can't tell us about. You also witnessed the aftermath of when I posed the chickens, frozen chickens in the butcher shop in sexually compromising positions that we called the Chicken Kama Sutra, and Dad kicked me in the ass and chased me out of the store.
Oh my God, yes. Right? Oh yeah, true story.
How'd that story go from the wings as you were watching it unfold, Nick?
Well, I was a participant in it. I mean, I thought it was hilarious. And I think the butchers thought it was hilarious too. And they were laughing because they really enjoyed what was going on, not because they were trying to get us in trouble. Like, let's see what happens. Right. So they weren't egging us on. They weren't doing anything like that. They were just genuinely laughing at what was pretty funny. And then of course it all came tumbling down and the chickens were leveled and all of that sort of thing. But
why did I get a swift kick in side footed in the butt?
Because that was your job.
And you didn't, you know?
Because that was your job as the older brother. You know, Jeff, I don't know if you have older brothers, older siblings or not, but I have two, John and Peter, who I modeled so much of my own character, just trying to navigate between those two guys. One of the things that they would do is they would take the hits. They would take the hits. And, you know, we were raised old school Greek family. So my mom had the spoon and, I was the baby of the family. So I got away with most of it, but
yeah, me too. My brother is almost 8 years older than I am. So he was certainly the shield that took most of the wrath when it came to our stupid shenanigans.
Exactly. You know, but that's part of what big brothers do, right, John?
Yeah.
Yeah. We take the fall our other brother Peter and I would turn and say to Dad, what about Nick? You know, what about Nick? Why do we always tend to? And he would say, Astopedi, meaning leave the boy alone, leave the child alone. You know,
so
we'd get our butts kicked whenever, you know, there was contraband once found in the house, and guess who took the fall? Me. And Nick didn't have to cut the grass because he was allergic. You know, he got away with so much. And then I've been at award ceremonies that if I told you, I'd have to be killed for it. But I've been at national award ceremonies where he's like, save the universe. And I'm thinking, this guy saves the universe. What happened to all the times he wouldn't cut the grass? you know.
Well, just let me say this though, in my defense, that you know, you always get, there's always payback in one way or the other. Right. And my youngest son Nico, who's named not after me but my father-in-law, is basically the same way. So he's paying me back for all of the shirking that I did as a young kid. So, you know, we're trying to get him used to walking the dog right now. And of course, around here, that means something we never had to do as a kid when you were walking the dog, right? You have to go, you know, go with bags and all that sort of
thing. Yeah.
When I first saw those out here, by the way, I thought they were birdhouses. I'm not kidding you. I saw these little perches where people would put bags on. And we were driving around 2004, my wife and I and our realtor into this neighborhood in Loudoun County. And I was like, oh, isn't that nice? They have little bird houses, but they're rather low. Why would the cats, you know, wouldn't they be able to get at them? So it really took me a while to figure out that those were the bags for the dog. But, you know, you learn.
So you are in Loudoun County. Can we just stop the, you know, I'm sure Jeff's going to ask you all about how you used to, you know, hit the sides of beef in the cooler at the store when you were, you know, training. But
Rocky.
Can we get into the Loudoun County thing for a second? You're in Loudoun County.
Yeah.
I'm seeing parents obsessed, or not obsessed, upset.
Yes.
And I'm seeing with critical race theory, and I'm seeing journalists telling people to don't be racist. Don't be fools. It's nothing. Don't worry about it. Why worry about it? It's nothing.
Right.
What's going on there in Loudoun County in your area where you live?
Well, I mean, I think it's really great to see people getting up on their hind legs and pushing back at the sort of torpor, you know, the sloth that you see from these city councils, or not city councils, maybe I'm thinking too much of Chicago, but the school boards where they just sit there and think that they have all the power and there's nothing that that can dislodge them. For many months right now, we have been meeting, I've been meeting with various cells of three. So, you know, I have a couple of different groups of people that I kind of hang out with in different worlds. And we would meet and commiserate and, you know, grumble about the way they were handling things, not only most recently with this whole identitarian politics, whatever you call it, CRT, whatever the neo-Marxist arcana is, it's less important than what the fact of it is. But so a lot of that's going on. But there was also a lot of dismay about the way they ran things with respect to the COVID lockdowns, despite what seemed to be the evidence. And of course, now we're seeing that blow up as well. And so there was, I think, a budding frustration with the way in which they were treating our children, the clear emphasis on the what seemed to be the school, you know, the teachers, et cetera, at the expense of the children. And that clearly manifested itself not only with the COVID lockdown, but even with this ideological claptrap that they're trying to thrust on folks. And it's not. A reluctance to learn about racism or slavery and all of that sort of thing. That's more than legitimate. It's very, very important that people understand that, right? And people are taught that. And of course, here in Virginia in particular, with its very complex history on those issues, the leading slave state, so to speak, there's real heartfelt interest and desire to make sure that the full record is aired. But there's a difference between studying history and understanding history. And studying it through the particular lens that is being offered. And the fact that so many people are saying, are making comments that suggest they don't understand the difference between studying history and being indoctrinated into a particular way of looking at history or weaponizing history, to the extent that people don't see that, I find that rather depressing and sad. And it's not a question even of the content of the ideology itself. It's the very fact that this is the way that schools are trying to teach people to think, not or to not think, as the case may be. Regardless of what the ideology is, you should be able to think. Regardless of what the content is, what they should be teaching kids to be is somewhat skeptical, so that when they grow up, they can ask questions and know that they have a legitimate right to do that. And the process by which they are trying to teach folks, so to speak, about race and all of these other issues, I think is extremely dangerous and harmful to the ability of educated people to think and to speak freely. And I think people have had enough of it here. I mean, they've paid attention a lot. There are a lot of Havel's green grocers out here, folks who will go along because they worry that, you know, they can be crushed if they don't. And it's the easiest way. It's a path of least resistance. But I think you're starting to see it reach critical mass now. And I hope it does. I hope it spurs a conversation abroad. You know, people like to say we should have a conversation about stuff. Well, I hope it spurs a real dialogue, because I think at this point, in so many ways, it hasn't been about dialogue. It hasn't been about trying to understand. It's about trying to impose. It's an ideological warfare masquerading as education. And that has to stop. That just has to stop.
Well, Nick, we've talked about this in the past, you and I, when we're kicking this around, and you called me up after we had Charles Lipson on the program. The issue was then and still is, how do we know what we know? How could we be sure of what we know? How can we even process complicated issues and events that require clarity in order for us to stay alive as a nation?
Yeah.
And I see this, you know, I remember years ago when Ted Koppel would say on Nightline, we must have a conversation about race, but it really wasn't a conversation. It was just lectures, right? It was lecturing. It was the precursor to this CRT nonsense.
Right.
But when you apply it to foreign policy, Jeff and Nick, and we don't see things clearly, what is the danger?
Well, I mean, I think it's not only about foreign policy, but I think it's relates to the entire knowledge industry, if you can put it that way, academia, journalism, everything else. And as I say, what I find interesting is that in the 21st century, the 21st century has almost been a history of ideological dominance of one sort for sort of another in making policy. And you can get back to Iraq, WMD, you know, the drive to make Afghanistan and Iraq Jeffersonian democracies, you know, sort of with scant regard for what the actual realities are on the ground. And one of the things I've been struck with over the last couple of weeks, John, is I've been listening to your and reading your columns and listening to you on this podcast and others that you participated in, has been this idea that, you know, context and knowing your audience, knowing your target is really, really important. I mean, you have to have some sort of like an anthropological sense of what it is, what's going on the ground in the area that you are focusing on, whether it's Chicago, the City Hall, whether it's a neighborhood, whether it's, you know, some exotic part of Turkey or Iraq or Syria or whatever. You really have, there's no substitute to first understanding in its own terms, what's actually going on the ground out there. And it's from there that you would develop wise policy ideas that, you know, sort of take into account these endearing or enduring realities. And I think increasingly we've been getting away from that. We've been getting away from context. We've seen a lot of errors of omission, shall we say, in media and elsewhere, which kind of skews the focus on what these realities are. And we've gotten away from the idea of really trying to understand things on their own terms. And it's interesting. I think of this a lot, but the Kurds have a good word for this. They have Kurdish word is hizirkar. Hizirkar means thought worker. And it doesn't have necessarily the same connotation in Kurmanji that it might in English, but I think it's appropriate in English because increasingly I think what we've become is a nation of thought workers as opposed to a nation of thinkers. We take thoughts and we manipulate them and shape them and try to push them into an agenda that suits a purpose as opposed to sort of corresponding to the reality. And you see that a lot in foreign policy. I mean, it's a traditional failing in the United States to sort of to bring a missionary approach to the world. You know, we are going to make the world a better place, and that's a wonderful impulse. But at some point, you also have to it has to be governed by a realistic sense of the actual phenomenon that you're dealing with, the actual people, the actual societies and structures, because a lot of these places are not necessarily Afghanistan, which we tend to think of as a relatively primitive and crude place. The fact of the matter is a lot of these places that where we might find issues or rejection or resistance to some of our thinking about things are actually quite sophisticated and have their own historical ways of understanding things. And if you don't appreciate that, run the risk of real chaos down the road. And just to wrap this up, and forgive me for going on, but to make a long story even longer, that's what worries me about what's happening in the United States, where increasingly our elite is increasingly detached, much more secular and ideologically rigidly so secular. And, you know, the populace is a less, is, you know, obviously much more incoherent, shall we say, or, you know, variegated mass of people, but they tend to have different different point of view than the sort of radical point of view that's being fostered upon them. And I worry that over the long term, this approach will fail, as it is almost definitely bound to do. It will fail in terms of actually transforming people's minds, but will succeed in wrecking what we've had and then leaving us with nothing. And the effort to rebuild is going to be really, really difficult. So I hope we don't get to that point.
Isn't that the point of the, I mean, if history teaches us anything, Jeff, and please jump in here with my brother, but if history teaches us anything, Nick, isn't it that Marxists, and that's what they are. I mean, let's just admit it. It's not socialist Democrat, it's Marxist Democrat,
right,
or Marxist. That they are hell-bent on deconstructing every institution in the country, from government to church to our fundamental understanding or relationship with God is expressed in the various in the creeds, like the Nicene Creed, and also deconstructing public order with respect to just the other day, a man was accused or charged with murder. He was on the street. He had been charged with another crime, aggravated battery, been on the street. He should have been in jail, but he was out in time to shoot at people and inadvertently kill and be charged with murder by killing a civilian across the street. Not a right. gangbanger, a woman named Nicole Osborne, killing right. her. Yeah. And that's the deconstruction of the criminal justice system by so-called social justice warriors.
Right.
So it goes on and on.
Yeah, I think it's really, really a problem. And it's even more fascinating when you consider how this has been abetted by an establishment that has been looking for ideological energy to harness and potentially co-opt in a bid to sort of maintain the structure of the establishment. That's why, I mean, I always appreciate your reference to the Kamalists, the American Kamalists. I think it's so apt. I mean, I know people are thinking, casting about for metaphors, and sometimes people will say, oh, the media is the Praetorian Guard of this and that. Well, you know, I think, okay, who were the Praetorian Guards? They're a bunch of guys wearing armor who would kill you. Right,
badasses,
right?
Right.
These guys aren't badasses, but they are more of the courtier class, or the kind of weasel class, if I may.
And, I would say the eunuchs of the Ottoman Empire would be their model.
Yes, but since you're calling from Chicago, I would say that there's probably people at the University of Chicago who would take exception because there were some badass eunuchs in the Byzantine Empire, you know, like Narses. You know, you didn't want to mess with Narses. I mean, ask all the Vandals, right? So, so there is some of that, but
yes, Narses the eunuch was a badass. I would like Jeff to write a song to that effect.
Right, but, I'll get right on it.
Right.
But yeah, go on, Nick. I'm sorry.
But the point is, I think the American Kamalas thing is really interesting, because when you think about, you know, why is it an interesting, it's not a metaphor, but it's a descriptor for the kind of situation we're in. I mean, the Kamalists.
Speak up, Nick. Project there. Come on.
Mustafa Kemal Atatürk. Sorry, my microphone's slipping off my ear here.
Right.
But Mustafa Kemal Atatürk basically used a crisis, World War I and the ensuing independence war of Turkey, didn't want to let that crisis go to waste, and used that crisis to impose a radical secularist transformation on the remnants of the Ottoman Empire, people who thought they were fighting for the faith in defense of their Islamic lands, now found out that they were fighting for this new secularism from the West. You had to wear hats. You couldn't do this. You couldn't do that. They changed the alphabets. They outlawed the caliphate. They outlawed the Sufi orders, which had been so important to Turkish and Kurdish society there. They did all of these things and imposed an ideology, a rigid one, which punished transgressors. People who thought outside the box were crushed, were rendered persona non grata. They were called reactionaries and all of these sorts of terms. And it's amazing, because the Kemalists were also big proponers or believers, they would say, in science and scientific rationality. But of course, this was the 1920s and the 1930s. And, you know, people from Vogelin to Hayek and others have written extensively about the extent to which science was fetishized into an ideology of power and control. It was really
just like we're doing now.
Exactly. Yeah, so that's why the Kemalism was so interesting. And of course, they demonized normal people. They demonized everybody. They demonized minorities. You know, there were, you know, what, a couple hundred thousand Greeks in Constantinople, as it was still called in 1923, even after the population exchange between Greece and Turkey at the end of World War One and the ensuing independence war. And there's like 3,500 left because of the relentless pressure by the Kemalist, primarily the Kemalist state, in driving these folks out, because the existence of Hellenism in Turkey was seen as a dire threat to the nationalist project that Mustafa Kemal was trying to build by Turkifying everything. So if you were a Greek, if you were a Muslim, I mean, devout Muslim, if you were a member of the Naqshbandi Sufi order or some other Sufi order, you were considered a threat to the ideological edifice. And when that started to corrode by the 1990s, those folks, and it was predominantly a military-driven sort of, military was the repository of Kemalist sort of enforcement, but they started to enlist radical fringe elements in a bid to perpetuate themselves in power. Now, the Kemalists failed, but they gave life to these radical fringe elements and legitimized them in ways that they previously never would have done. And so you have a system now where the establishment, in trying to fight off President Trump or whatever, both parties, in particular on the Democratic side, has now made common cause with extremely radical elements. I'm not using that term with any kind of hyperbole. I mean, people are actually talking about rooting out things. I mean, that's the whole point of ripping down statues and overturning, you know, our the respect for our constitution or constitutional forms, for the very idea of free debate or free speech as some sort of bourgeois notion that was foisted on society. I mean, all of this is being abetted by an establishment that is seeking to maintain its control. But I think it's a really dangerous game. And you've seen plenty of examples now of senior leaders who make these extraordinarily sad comments about critical race theory and white rage. I mean, it's quite sad, actually.
I'm watching the generals and the admirals defending, imposing critical race theory and the propaganda documents and books and so forth upon the American military. And I'm struck by the fact that this is, you know, I can see the right wing is upset, like screaming, how dare you and all that. But I see it as eminently human that the human being that the bureaucratic nature of man will seek to just perpetuate himself or herself in the power system that's available, and damn principles and tradition and all that, because they're just covering for themselves. They are the Kemalists of the modern day,
and they would put up narratives to shore up their power. That's like one of the oldest tricks in the book. And so what I found interesting in the previous, during the previous administration, was the extent to which mainstream, so to speak, intellectuals, establishmentarian figures, journalists in particular, would call upon the military in some way, shape or other to quote unquote push back against Donald Trump.
Right.
And it reminds me of a lot of the press we would see in Turkey. There's one famous headline where after the rise of, I think it was after the rise of the AKP, the current party, there was a headline in the newspaper after some event where they said the generals were uneasy. And that was, and given a history in Turkey where, you know, you had five military coups and, you know, the continuous effort of the military to intervene in politics, something like that sends shockwaves throughout the society. And so I think that the extent to which establishment figures are roping in the military in an effort to beat up on their political opponents is a very, very dangerous and frankly un-American thing, un-American in the sense of interpretation of the Constitution. It's really not a constitution. It's not the way the Constitution is supposed to work. And secondly, just as a, again, we're supposed to be the land of the free and the home of the brave. And one of the things you're supposed to be able to do is to speak your mind. And it's really kind of unfortunate. I mean, it is sad to say, but, you know, over the last 5 years or so, people have used this term deep state in American politics. Now, you know, one can debate the relevance of the deep state term, et cetera. You know, whether or not that's been misused, whether or not that's an exaggeration, all of that's fair to talk about. But it is Turkey's contribution to American political discourse. The term was derin devlet in Turkish. And now that's, you know, a popular thing. It's on a popular thing on the right now. I suspect that in the future, it could become popular on the left again. So
We have to ask you about that photograph that you supplied for the podcast. It's sure. You're sitting there with a person you know very well.
Right.
Tell us about him. Can you?
Well, it's Abdul Baki Hashimi, who is a sheikh of the Naqshbandi and Qadiri and Rufai orders out in Jizre. And as a matter of fact, his family is the Sheikhli and Sayyid family. Sayyids are people who are known as the descendants of the Prophet. And so that's in and of itself a big deal in a traditional society like Kurdistan, even in the Turkish parts of Kurdish areas of Turkey. And he was a really terrific guy, very nice man, a very, very smart guy, and knows an awful lot about Islam. And to me, he represented the kind of view on Islam, which often gets short shrift and often did get short shrift in the early parts of the 21st century in the United States, when for a variety of different reasons, people focused on Islam as a, or theological thinking generally as beyond the pale and as dangerous. And that led to justifications for our staying in Afghanistan to, you know, modernize the place because only modern ways of thought are acceptable in this kind of way. And of course, you know, he was a guy who's a Kurd and a Muslim, a very devout Muslim, and also very just an open-hearted, good soul. And it's really interesting that when you get to know human beings, actual humans, people in an area, you find out that it doesn't correspond necessarily with the agendas that are being pushed by one faction or the other. And it's ironic. I'm glad you brought him up. It's ironic because if you read the New York Times, for example, and the Washington Post or all these other newspapers, you would never know that Kurds are very, very devout people. You would think that the Kurds are, you know, promoting, you know, sort of the latest version of left-wing politics in Syria.
Yeah, they're like the Kurdish Kurdish Lives Matter.
Yeah, I mean, you'd read these. I would read these books, and you know, these people would write these books about the Kurds, and I would, you know, look into the index, and you know, the word Islam would be mentioned once, and I was thinking, you know, Islam has been a formative element of their character. What does it mean to be a Kurd? If you ask a guy like Sheikh Hashimi here, or his brother, another good friend of mine, or his nephews and grandchildren, they would say, well, to be a Kurd is to be a Muslim, right? Now, it doesn't mean that all Kurds are Muslims. There are many, you know, what they call Yazidi Kurds, or it's kind of Zoroastrianism, maybe. And those Kurds will say that they were the original Kurds, right? But it does point to the fact that how religion is an important element of the formation of the character, not just in the identity sense, but in the actual formation of the character of these people. Big swaths, and particularly for the Kurmanji Kurds in particular. So again, what that shows is that there is a reality that exists independently of what is being transferred to American people via their media. And it's just astounding. I read these things. I mean, I don't know to what extent it's being duplicated in other areas. I only can tell you based on my own experience and my relatively, you know, in-depth understanding of the particular area that, you know, I focused on in the Aegean and, you know, points east. But there's a lot of BS out there.
Nick, I think that part of it is laziness. And part of it is cynicism. I think the smart propagandists in media and in politics are cynics who are manipulating. So they'll push something like, oh, you know, they'll talk about social justice with respect to the Innocence Projects or something, and ignore the fellow that walked across the street that should have been in jail and walked across the street and shot.
Yeah,
this woman across the street that I talked about, Nicole Osborne, mm-hmm. or they'll do the true believers, and this is what makes me ill about media. The true believers will just ignore it rather than violate their religious, quasi-religious obligations to their politics at the expense of the people knowing what's going on.
Yeah.
And that is to me the fundamental and deep damning sin of what's going on in American media today.
Well, and it's been, and the sad thing is, it was going on elsewhere, and one would always have this feeling that, you know, at least it's not happening in the United States. There's still a commitment to this, and we've seen that collapse really, really quickly. It's one of the most it hasn't been that quick. I mean, it appears quick. I mean, people have been working on, you know, sort of capture of the institutions, whatever, for a long, long time. But
it happened, and it happened with the pushing of the Iraq War. And I felt I'm accepting you from this discussion, but yeah. You're just listening to this part. I bought into that. We have to go to war to push democracy, right? We have to go to war because mm-hmm. some women are in burqas. We have to kill Americans and Afghanis because of burqas.
Yeah.
Please. You know, I can't believe, but I went along with it. And then you've seen the deconstruction of this narrative time and time again from the other side, from Wuhan was not born in a lab, right?
Right.
And to all the variations of the Trump is a Russian spy.
Oh my God.
Theory.
Yeah. All of this was designed, I think, or promoted in an effort of some people to maintain their position in power. And they would enlist any tool at their disposal. The irony is they've also enlisted this radical left wing view, which will devour them. And you've written about that, I think, a number of your columns.
We're seeing it now. Just look at Chicago.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
look at Chicago, guys. We saw Mayor Lightfoot being devoured by the hard left during the riots, and then she moved farther to the left. But there are liberal aldermen in Chicago today being devoured and called liberal aldermen being called white supremacists.
Yeah,
by the radical left because they didn't want to go along with the renaming of Lakeshore Drive for a man who may have sold whiskey to the Indians, right?
You know, yeah, I mean, that's, it was, that was, I mean, it's one of the more, it's just so sad. You think about all these people who are suffering, dying, and this is the answer. This is what they get. I mean, you can imagine that that's not going to sit well over time. And there will be people who will leave, and people will also have take other sort of steps. And it's really unfortunate, but it you know, it's interesting when you think about it, because it's designed to promote this cloud of BS. And it gets back, it's kind of reminds me of one of the things, what started me off on this rant here. But so I hope you guys forgive me, and your listeners forgive me. But when we were talking initially about this, it was the question about how do you know what you know? And there's no real substitute as a necessary, if not sufficient, element here to understand the phenomenon that you're dealing with on its own terms. Really be in the area, understand the area, don't mail it in, right? And one of the things that I always learned from you, and that actually I tried to carry over into my work, was precisely that kind of understanding. And it has universal application, by the way. And the reason being that if you don't operate that way, if you, as a journalist or whomever, thought worker, are operating in an environment where you don't understand that, but the people to whom you are with whom you are engaging do, then you will be their fool. You will be their tool. You will be manipulated by them. And we've seen that time and time again. And it's a sad commentary on journalism that, for example, that we haven't seen any lessons learned from any of this. And as a matter of fact, we've seen more of a doubling down. We were talking a little bit earlier about the whole Ben Rhodes comment about journalists as 27-year-old nothings who could be led around by the nose. I can't remember specifically what that is.
It was Ben Rhodes, the advisor to Barack Obama, congratulating himself in a preening New York Times magazine piece. Right. About how he manipulated the press into support, the American press, into creating an echo chamber, allowing them to push the Iranian nuclear deal, and which was it's a horrific deal for the Middle East, my opinion, not yours, mine, for the Middle East, America, Israel, and much of the Arab nations, and he said. It was easy to create this echo chamber because American reporters are 27-year-old know-nothings. And I thought that the distillation of all the arrogance of the Obama and now the Obama-Biden, I think it's called O-Biden, O-apostrophe B-I-D-A-N, with Susan Rice pulling the strings as the puppeteer, is that 27-year-old know nothings and they manipulate and smirk
those 27s are now 41 and they're the bureau chiefs, right, the editors, right. And they're rather than actually looking at that and focusing on that and saying, regardless of the issue. And again, that could be done. It could be done to serve a Democratic or a Republican partisan point. But that kind of manipulation should have set off alarm bells. And instead, it's almost like, thank you, sir. May I have another? And I think that's really, really kind of actually quite pathetic.
It's the scariest part in all that is that, I mean, you're right, because I work in media, obviously, and so I have lots of people I work with in newsrooms, and the majority of the people that are writing news or researching, I'm putting air quotes around that, a lot of people have a degree in history or a degree in politics and a degree in communications, and they have no journalism, and they may have taken some classwork, but they don't have a journalism degree. They aren't studying the idea of backing up their information or having multiple sources to confirm a thought or an idea, and none of that. And then you compound it against them. Their competition now for most journalists is social media, because it's easier for people, and that can be impacted and manipulated by outside sources from people outside our own country.
Yes.
And so now you see that there's just a onslaught of just crap that is unfiltered, is unusable. but people use it, and it's like you guys are saying, it's become this kind of cutting out our legs from under us without even knowing it. It's just terrifying.
That is terrifying. Jeff, that's, to me, that's, you're hitting it like right on the head, because it's one thing if you're a cynic. At least the cynic, like I imagine, you know, like the old fashioned Reds who would be driving so much of this stuff, and maybe many of them today, you know, some of them at least who, you know, have financed, you know, the purchase of fine houses with the money they've been able to receive and various contributions. Those folks, you know, at least they understood, they could understand, right? Yeah. Now you have so many people who don't, and I think that's almost more tragic. It used to be, like, I've been in situations, for example, where people would be explaining something, and there would be, like, a pained expression on everyone's face, and you're like, okay, well, this person, you know, obviously needs more seasoning, they're going to learn more, this kind of thing. And then, or then you'd get to these other more formal places where they adopt the same kind of analytical line on story X, and, you know, the retort would be, and, you know, someone would, after hearing that, would say, and that's the extent of your analysis? And that would be a dagger to the heart of, like, it would be like, oh, whoa, you know, that would be like a major blow to your credibility to get that kind of action or reaction to your, to what you've said. And I don't know if people are even capable of so many people have lost the capacity to be able to have that kind of reaction, precisely because they don't think beyond whatever it is that they're what they're working on, their little format or whatever it is. And it's just, to me, it's a tragedy. There are many, many good people out there. We can't afford to have that happen. I think of all the folks, John, that, for example, you named in your newspaper, your former legman who you helped train. I mean, I know they're all terrific reporters, or others, folks at the Sun-Times that you have obviously respect for, and elsewhere, and in other parts of the media, there are a lot of good folks that you like. And I just hope that after this period, you know, of revolutionary fervor quiets down and fails, because it will fail. It will fail in doing its job. It will fail in explaining what's really going on. It will not allow, it will not give people the information or sense that what they are hearing reflects the reality that is apparent to them. You're seeing that now. So eventually that's going to fail. And I just hope that there are enough people like those Irish monks, you know, after the fall of the Western Empire, of course, the East lasted till 1453. But after the fall of the Western Empire, who helped, you know, maintain and piece together, you know, the classical tradition. So I hope that we can get there. You know, it's interesting. And let me add this thing. I was at, didn't go to church yesterday, but I was watching it virtually, our church out here. And we have a young missionary, a priest who was ordained, who is going out to Guatemala for mission work. And he was ordained by the Archbishop, Melpi LaForest. And what I was really heartened by, not only, of course, all of the how important this could be to the faith and all that sort of thing, but the new priest's comments were that I'm going down there to do the work of Christ without any special attention to ideology of left or right. And I think that speaks to where the reality is. You cannot think in ideological terms at all. You have to focus on the reality. And for believers, of course, the true reality is the divine. But the point was, he was not going to let ideological pressure from left or right obscure his focus on the truth. And I was heartened by that. And I hope to think that whether you're secular or religious, and there are many secular people who feel this way. I mean, I assume Glenn Greenwald is a secular individual, and I read him a lot, and there are others. Maybe I'm mischaracterizing Glenn Greenwald. I don't know if he is secular or not, but clearly he writes in a secular cast, and he's a very, very clear critic of what's going on. And I suspect that there may be enough people who survive this onslaught to help rebuild what's going on, but it's going to take a lot of work.
Nick Cass, the smartest man I know.
Oh, my God. Sorry, you've got to get out, John. You got to get out more, man.
Hey, Nick, you talked brilliantly about all this epistemological stuff, which is important, that Jeff hasn't been able to ask you why the hell did you pound sides of beef and dad's in our meat cooler?
Because of Rocky, man. Everybody did right. that. I mean, it was 1976. That was like studying Kyokushin karate on the South Side, which is a bare knuckle form of full contact martial arts. And there would be nothing better than to like toughen your hands up by doing that. Of course, in the movie, the meat is thawed and it's soft.
Just gonna say.
But you know, John will attest to this. But when you're taking meat off the truck and hanging it up, yeah. it's very cold and does not move. And so you're basically hitting rocks. But yeah, everyone was doing it, and that was a kick. It was kind of fun. I mean, John, you may not know this, Jeff, but John was a student of the Kyokushin. Our teacher was Hanshi Gregory Johnson. Nice. Recently passed away in Southside. He was a former cop and trainer of police, and he was the toughest customer around. I mean, he was not the kind of guy who was going to do a fancy Bruce Lee kick, but he would put you down, right, in a very, very realistic and quick way. Wouldn't be rolling around on the ground. And
I guess I used those techniques to save Franz Spielman's life.
Well, right? It's only because you it's only because you trained hard fighting female Secret okay. Service agents.
John Cass, misogynist story, and this is it. Listen to the he's been planning this one for a long time about how he beat up a girl. Okay,
well, you know, yeah. So anyway, Hanshi Johnson, would have a variety of different people in his dojo, and a couple of them were police officers. Some of the toughest guys I ever saw. There was this one guy named I hope he's still out there. Police guys and women, but there was a guy, Sensei McGreal. I hope he's out there listening. But I remember Sensei Johnson hit him with a hard overhand right, full contact, right in the mouth while they were sparring. And he just like turned his head, spit out his teeth, and kept going. I mean, that's the kind of people that were there. And there were some really good female police officers who really needed to learn how to fight. And one of them went on to be a very, very important Secret Service agent during the Reagan era and after. And so she had to spar John, or John had to spar her. And, John, of course, being the guy, and this being, you know, the 80s, you know, we're like, oh, okay, you know, this kind of thing. But then Hanshi Johnson got really upset. He's like, you got to fight her. If you don't, you know, she's not going to learn how to do this. And so John started to fight her a little bit. And then within 5 seconds, he looked down and he had like 10 claw marks across his chest. And I was
bleeding.
And I was thinking about this, and it reminded me of that movie, The Last Last of the Mohicans, where Uncas jumps up to fight West Studi at the end, and they're fighting, and West Studi is Magua, the great, great character of Magua. He's flashing around with his tomahawk and his t-shirt and his knife, and Uncas looks down and he's all like, oh, cut up. So John was like Uncas, having been slain by
Donna.
Yeah. And then I think it's you punched her or something really hard.
I looked down and I punched her.
Yeah.
And Nick has never let, and I punched her in the mouth. Okay. Yeah. And Nick has never let me forget it, but it wasn't my fault.
But that's only because
I was trying to make it better.
You would never let me forget the hen killer story.
Okay. Yeah. So okay.
You and the prosecutor, Peter, would never let me forget the hen killer story, which, you know.
Yeah, Nick's a hen killer, and we'd go hunting, and you're not supposed to shoot the hens, but Nick would see the hen flying up there, and occasionally he would add meat to the pot illegally. But that's another story.
Yeah.
And right now we have to say goodbye to our guests. I hope you will come back
on the
Chicago way now that you're free of the cares of diplomacy.
I've kissed goodbye the howling beast on the borderline.
Yeah, that's great.
All right.
It was great. Oh, sorry, John. Go ahead.
No, thank you, Nick. Thanks, man.
Yeah, thanks,
you
guys. Nick.
Thanks for having me. Thanks for having me.
You are the smartest guy I know.
Come on, stop. Get out more.
All right. For Nicholas Cass, the smartest man I know, the pounder of beef ribs in our dad's store, who became a senior diplomat and assistant secretary of state and national security council and all this stuff for our federal government, for serving us. Thank you, Nick. And for Jeff Carlin, executive producer of WGN Radio, my friend, who may someday bake me the fruit pie that I've been waiting for several years now. And for you, all of you who've joining in on this great adventure of the Chicago Way, which is linked to johncastnews.com and all the other stuff that we're going to be doing, I want to thank you. And for me, John Cass, husband, father, wait for it now, different, proprietor of johncastnews.com and member of its editorial board, because I am the editorial board. See you next time. We'll talk next time when we talk 4th of July and how to catch wild pigs on the Chicago Way on WGN Plus.